Thanks, Byron. Good afternoon to everybody. Glad to have each one of you with us tonight. I want to mention, as Barney referred to start with tonight, we do have different ones of our brothers and sisters scattered in a lot of activities right now. We have a group at Happy Hollow this week. Larry's group is there. I think Adam got to stay around home a night or two, and now he's headed out there tonight, and I think they'll enjoy a good warm week, so keep them in your prayers this week. John and Coita are down at West Plains, and if you haven't heard, they did move Coita's dad back to the nursing home today, so that family needs to be remembered in our prayers. Leona and Bob let us know that Kelly re-entered the hospital last night, and he has a fever again, so remember him while he continues to go through the treatment for the leukemia issue that he is dealing with. We have, of course, Dale and Pat Hart, and we have others that surely do need to be remembered. Kyle and Alyssa are headed off to a cooler climate to work in a Bible camp this summer. And I want them to know I can offer them a warmer deal about the third week in July. If you struggle with the temperatures, Kyle, you know where to find us. And I hope you guys have a great time. I know you'll be a blessing to the folks up in that area. We started last week a little bit of reflection on the messages of the minor prophets, the messages of the minor prophets to the world in which they lived, and the messages that the people of God needed to hear about the world in which they live. We tried last week to remind ourselves a bit about the role of the prophets. Tonight we begin, we'll look at just one idea from each one of these. And tonight we're dealing with Hosea. Maybe most of you say it Hosea. I've always said it Hosea. I think that may be force of habit. You take your pick, but you'll know who I'm talking about tonight as we read. This man is known as the prophet of the broken heart, and he's a messenger unlike most of the other prophets of the Old Testament, because he has in some ways a sad message. And God calls him to do something more than just tell it. He calls him to live it first. And that will mean more to us when we see what living it meant, and as we reflect on the message of this book tonight. The prophet of the broken heart, ironically, talks most about the long-suffering love of God. And the reason for the broken heart here is not that God loves and loves and loves. It's that His people don't. His people don't respond with the kind of love that ought to be shown. We need to be familiar with the concept of covenant in order to understand the message of this book. The word that it uses for loving kindness, if you have the New American Standard Version, or mercy, if you're reading the King James, or steadfast love in the English Standard Version that I'm using here, is the great word that has reference to covenant love. It's the kind of love that you promise and accept and commit yourself to. One writer that I have found recently describes the concept of covenant in a way that I appreciate. He says, a covenant is a relationship much more intimate and loving than a mere legal contract could create, yet one more enduring and binding than personal affection alone could make. It's a bond of love made more intimate because more intimate and solid because it's legal. It's the opposite of a consumer-vendor relationship in which the connection is maintained only if it serves the both parties' self-interests. A covenant, by contrast, is the solemn, permanent, whole self-giving of two parties to each other. Now that's what a covenant is. That's what God offered Israel, and that's what Israel accepted and committed herself to at Mount Sinai. And that background helps us to see the problem that Hosea is talking about. I'll try to keep it in my mind this way, and I want to suggest it to you. This whole message starts with the idea of God saying, "What will I do with you? Your love is like a morning cloud." Look at Hosea 6 and verses 4 through 6. And remember, when I read about love, I'm talking about something that should be covenant love. He says, "What shall I do with you, O Ephraim?" One of the marks of this book is that it uses the Ephraim, one of the tribes, one of the sons of Joseph, to stand for the whole northern kingdom, the whole 10 tribes. "What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes early away." Now, you think of an Ozark Hills here, and a lot of you are familiar with the early morning and some of the valleys and with the foggy mist that's hanging out there. And you think, "Oh, it's going to be nice, cool." Well, you think that if you're not from here. You know that it's not going to last very long. And that's what Hosea is telling or saying about Israel's love. "Therefore I have hewn them by the prophets, I've slain them by the words of my mouth, and my judgment goes forth as the light, for I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, and knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings." God is saying, I want to be loved. I want your committed love. I want your faithfulness. I want that more than just the rituals of offering sacrifices. But what I have found out is your love is like a morning cloud. Now, here's something that helps you to be more impressed with that picture. Hosea does his work right about the time when the northern kingdom is going to be captured and carried away by the Assyrians. And what's happened is that for many years before that, Israel has enjoyed a time of peace and prosperity and ease. They've not been threatened by many enemies. They haven't had a great deal of international turmoil. There haven't been depressions and economic crises and famines and all that kind of thing. But Israel's love has not been strong enough to endure prosperity. Israel's love has not been able to outlast blessings or ease, and that in a way is more remarkable and helps us to think about this book. Now, here's the situation that the prophet says that God has seen. The problem with Israel is that while God has been looking for, desiring steadfast love, he looks out and he doesn't see any among his covenant people. Verse 1 of chapter 4 says, "Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land." The word controversy usually means lawsuit. He has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. "There is no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land." It's not just any nation either. This is the supposed to be the covenant people, but there's no trustworthiness, no reliability, no love that you can count on among them. And what Hosea is known for then is the two pictures of this lack of steadfast love that he uses. One is the more famous one, the picture of the unfaithful wife. In chapter 1, in verses 3 through 9, God sends our friend Hosea, whose name means the Lord saves, to marry a wife who has been a harlot or a prostitute. The King James and the English Standard Version use the word who has been in whoredom to suggest that I want you to take a wife of the kind of character who has not simply sold herself for wages of immorality. She's given herself to it even without benefiting from it financially. And he goes and marries a woman, and this is funny to us, the name, but her name is Gomer. They're blessed first with the child that they name God Scatters, or Jezreel. And then she conceives again. I read it as if she's been unfaithful to him. And they name the next one, No Mercy. And then she has another child, and they name that child Not My People. So God Scatters, No Mercy, Not My People. That's what you call a tough family right there, isn't it? You have a wife of unfaithfulness, and then each child's name is a message about the widening gap between the faithful God and then his unfaithful people. And of course, the point is not just that Hosea has family problems, but the unfaithfulness. God's heart gets hurt. God's heart is broken like a husband's would be when he loved his wife, but she was that unfaithful to him. And when he made a covenant of love with her, and then that covenant was not honored. The other picture that Hosea uses is the picture of the original picture of the prodigal son in chapter 11 of this book. The ingratitude of that God feels for his stubborn and rebellious, ingratitude that he has felt from his stubborn and rebellious children is illustrated. This is verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. That's made even more bittersweet when we remember the way the New Testament uses it of Jesus. And then the more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals. We commented on the Baals last Sunday night, and burning offerings to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. Can you imagine a father teaching his little boy or girl to walk? Here, come here. And then he supports them and holds them up. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. And I bent down to them and fed them. But then he says, if you skip down to verse 7, I'll ask you to look down there. My people are bent on turning away from me, and though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. He can't pick them up in his arms anymore. His heart's broken by their unfaithfulness. His love has not been returned. Now what happens in this book and the drama of it is that God decides to seek the hearts of his people back. He wants his stubborn child to open up his heart for him. He wants his unfaithful wife to come back home where he can love her exclusively. But for that change of heart to happen, he has to let them find out what it's like to live without steadfast love. So this book shows God issuing a kind of judgment toward his people by allowing them to experience what life is when there is no practice of steadfast love. This is one of the most thought-provoking pictures of a culture and of a society I can imagine. At chapter 8 and verse 1, look at this picture. Set the trumpet to your lips. One like a vulture is over the house of the Lord because they've transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. Some of you have never seen an old vulture circling over the carrion, waiting for it to be dead enough for him to feast on it. On the farm back home, we saw that sometimes. What an awful picture of dread that is. But look at what happens as the decay eats the society from within. In chapter 4, at verses 1 and following, we read that the land mourns and all the people are in anguish. There's no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds and bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and all the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, and even the fish of the sea are taken away. Skip down to verse 10. They shall eat, but not be satisfied. They shall play the whore, but not multiply, because they have forsaken the Lord to cherish whoredom, wine, and new wine, which take away the understanding. My people inquire, they worship, they pray to, they seek a piece of wood, and their walking staff provides them oracles. You have to see that picture. They are shriveling away and asking their walking sticks what they ought to do. That's futility. And that's what it's like to live without there being the honorable practice of steadfast love in families and communities and in the land itself. Another picture of this same kind of judgment is chapter 6, verses 7 through 10. But like men, they transgress the covenant, and they dealt faithlessly with me. Gilead is a city of evildoers tracked with blood. As robbers lie in wait for a man, so the priests gather or band together. They murder on the way to Shechem. They commit villainy. Shechem was one of the places they went for worship. A city of evildoers tracked with blood. Eventually, you see, when God simply lets us go to the inability to practice unselfish, committed love, without the ability to be faithful even when we don't personally gain materially from it at that moment, what we lose as a society is described in passages like this. Our own time ought to be one when we think about this and when we consider why things happen like they do. Now, the reason this is a book in the Bible is God's not content to let it end there. What Hosea says for God is, I will heal their apostasy. I'll love them freely. This is chapter 14 and verse 4. There's two pictures of God at work, and they match what we've read just a few moments ago about the conduct of the people. They may have been like the prodigal sons, but God is still a merciful Father. Look at chapter 11, verses 8 and 9. Remember their rebellion and their hatefulness in the back of this. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? Can you hear God's heart in a passage like that? This is His word to His children. How can I give you up? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboiim? These are terms for areas or cities in foreign regions nearby. My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I'll not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. And what he's saying, I'm God and not a man. You may forget steadfast love. You may not practice it, but I can't forget it. That's my nature. That's who I am. Even if you don't honor the covenant, I made a promise and I'm going to pursue it in the long run, even if you individuals of this generation miss out on it. Even if you individual persons bear the curse of the covenant instead of the blessing, I'm still going to aim to fulfill my purposes. And God is saying that in this book. And then he's like the long-suffering husband. In chapter 1, after the unfaithfulness of Gomer becomes apparent, the lesson is driven home. In chapter 2, verse 14, God says, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness," which he does by the handing her over to her to the enemies of Israel, "and I'll speak tenderly to her." When she is, in other words, when she is hurting, when there's nothing I could gain from it, I will speak tenderly to her. I will woo her. I will seek her heart. This is an amazing kind of steadfast love here. Verse 19, he says, "And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and mercy. I'll betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord." In verse 23, "And I will have mercy on no mercy, and I will say to not my people, you are my people, and he shall say, you are my God." Interestingly, these are the words Peter uses in 1 Peter 2 in verses 9 and 10 to talk about how we who were no people receive mercy and how we become holy to the Lord God. So here is God taking a people with no steadfast love and suffering from the lack of steadfast love and expressing steadfast love to them like a merciful father or a long-suffering husband. And that changes the tone of things. That introduces hope into the story. Hosea speaks of hope that consists of opportunity to return to steadfast love. It's like resurrection love, really. In chapter 13, look at verse 14. "Shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol or from the grave? Shall I redeem them from death? O death, where are your plagues? O Sheol, where's your sting?" Those are the words Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 15 to talk about the resurrection. And God answered his own question, "Yes, I will. I will redeem them. I'll bring them back from death. I'll raise them up again and give them life. And the reason will be my own compassion." So what Hosea says to his people is, let's take advantage of the invitation to return to the Lord. Let's go back and to steadfast love, and let's begin again to practice that kind of love, to respond to God's offer of covenant, to be His people, to know Him. Look at chapter 14 in verses 1 through 3. Prophet says, "Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take with you words and return to the Lord. Say to Him, take away all iniquity, accept what's good, and we will pay with bulls and the vows of our lips." Now, they don't mean they think they can pay God off, but they're offering to fulfill their covenant obligations. They're being encouraged to offer to do that at least. "Assyria shall not save us." I guess not. They carried them away. They destroyed the place and carried them away. "Assyria shall not save us. We'll not ride on horses. We'll say no more, our God, to the work of our own hands. In you, the orphan finds mercy." We're going to quit asking our walking stick what we ought to do. And we're going to start praying to our Father and loving him faithfully instead. Look at chapter 6 in verses 1 through 3. This is where Israel decides we're going to take the encouragement of the prophet and do what he says. Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us that he may heal us. In other words, this experience of loss has been so that we can come to our senses like the prodigal in the far country, and so that God can heal us, our God can heal us. He has struck us down and he'll bind us up. After 2 days, he'll revive us, and on the third day, he will raise us up that we may live before him. Let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going out is sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers, as the spring rains that water the earth. That's the faith that they have, is that it'll be better for us under God's care. And we see that now. Friends, where all do we need steadfast love in our lives and in our culture right now? Where all do we need people who will make a promise and keep it? People who will make a commitment and fulfill it, even if it costs them and if they don't gain from it right then. People you can count on, whose word you can take. People you're not afraid to live by. People who are no threat of any bloody violence. People that you know are going to try to do what's honorable and meet their own obligation to a power higher than they themselves are. We need that kind of love everywhere. We ought to read and reread and rejoice in the message of the prophet Hosea. I noticed in my daily Bible reading a while back, Psalm 138 and verse 8. It says, "The Lord will fulfill his purpose for me. Your steadfast love, O Lord, endures forever. Do not forsake the work of your hands." Isn't that a great statement? Contrast it with where we started. Remember, "What shall I do with you? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that burns off." Look at this. "Your steadfast love, O Lord, endures forever." A child of God can draw near to him and know that God won't forsake him, but we ought to also determine we won't forsake him either. Tonight, if you're willing to love back that kind of a lover, won't you say so? If you need to be obedient to the gospel, let us know by coming and while we stand and sing. And if you need prayers in your behalf in some way, let us know that too. Come while we stand and sing together.